This podcast is sponsored by Cellar Plan from Berry Brothers and Rudd, collecting fine wines for future drinking.
Welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman. On this week's episode, we'll be discussing Trump versus technology, the new normal with Calamity May, and whether jargon is polluting the English language. First up, in this week's magazine cover piece, Neil Ferguson writes on the battle between networks and hierarchies for supremacy in a digital world. The biggest fight is between the American president and the social networks like Facebook and Twitter, who still exist in the unregulated frontier of the wild, wild west of the World Wide Web. Neil joined Freddie Gray, host of the Spectator's Americano podcast, to discuss.
So Neil, in your excellent piece this week, you suggest that the battle of the next millennium is going to be between social media, the Silicon Valley, and let's say a hierarchy as represented by someone like Donald Trump. Can you explain a bit what you mean?
Well, I don't think it'll quite be the next millennium. I'll settle for the next few weeks.
Yes.
As my time horizon. The battle between networks and hierarchies is age old, as I say in my new book, The Square and the Tower, available in all good bookstores. But what we're seeing at the moment is a new phase of it. And in this phase, the giant social networks created by Silicon Valley, Facebook, Twitter, and the rest, come into collision with the most powerful hierarchy in the world, which is the federal government of the United States. And the way this is going to happen is as follows. Slowly, Republicans are going to wake up to the fact that Silicon Valley is stacked against them. It will never be 2016 again. In other words, there will never be another Republican candidate who can use Facebook and Twitter the way Donald Trump did, in a way that I think was decisive in the 2016 election, because Silicon Valley is now overtly on the liberal side, and Facebook will tweak the algorithms to make sure that the populist conservative messages out there don't make it onto the news feed. And that's really important when 45% of Americans get their news from the Facebook news feed. Republicans haven't quite grasped the magnitude of the threat yet. I think Steve Bannon spotted it before he was shipped out of the White House. But the fact that just the other day Trump fired a tweet straight at Facebook tells you that he's woken up to it. And it's going to be a titanic struggle because these are two very powerful forces, Silicon Valley and the Trump administration. It's going to be fun.
But also, to what extent do Facebook and Twitter need to be aware of how quickly it can go wrong for them? If they do start shutting down networks, they will soon be unable to be the networks they claim, the free roaming networks they claim to be.
Well, a year ago when I moved to Stanford, which is right next to Silicon Valley, I was struck by the hubris I encountered there. The general view was resistance is futile, our technology is awesome, history is bunk, and the rest is really predictable by our algorithms. And within the space of 12 months, we went from hubris to nemesis. Nemesis is the revelation that those platforms were used not only by the Trump campaign, but also by Russian intelligence. Let's not forget Islamic State and a whole bunch of other malefactors. So I think Silicon Valley is wakening up with sickening feeling in the pit of its stomach to the fact that the wonderful networked world that they created, which was supposed to create a global community, in Mark Zuckerberg's phrase, actually isn't like that at all. And the tools of mass distraction can also be used for a whole variety of nefarious purposes. So there's been a chorus of, gee, I never thought it would be like this, from people like Sheryl Sandberg, chief operating officer at Facebook, who had to grovel when it was revealed that anti-Semitic groups had been using Facebook to target fellow anti-Semites with advertising. I think that's what's been going on in the last year. So they know that storm clouds are gathering because they're gathering over the Russian meddling in the election, they're gathering over the role that white supremacists have been able to play online. But I don't think it's fully apparent the nature of the threat. And here's why. Most of the noise politically so far has come from the Democrats, from left-leaning Democrats, who've started beating the antitrust drum, the old progressive cause of trust busting. And so there's a bunch of left-wing Democrats who are crying monopoly and saying it's time we broke up the giants of Silicon Valley. That's got most of the attention in the media coverage of the backlash against Silicon Valley. And that's a complete distraction, I think, because it's never going to happen. Mm. It's not going to happen because, A, Silicon Valley funds the Democratic Party on a massive scale and can essentially marginalize those voices. That's even happening at the moment. B, the legal framework, the current interpretation of antitrust in the US courts is not friendly to that approach. Since the 1960s, really, when the Chicago school got the upper hand, the general test has been it's a monopoly if the public is overpaying for the service.
Yes.
But guess what? The services are free. That's the standard Silicon Valley line. How can it be a monopoly, says Jeff Bezos, when I make stuff cheaper? So I think the whole antitrust thing is a little bit of a red herring. The real issue is regulation. And Republicans don't like that word because they do deregulation, and therefore they're being a bit slow on the uptake. But there is a very, very important piece of regulation, 1996 law, that governs the operation of these network platforms, and it grants them a remarkable exemption. Essentially, since the mid-1990s, Silicon Valley companies that effectively publish content online are not regulated as publishers with any liability at all for the content. They are treated as these things called platforms, no, not railway platforms, platforms on the internet, where other people's content just materializes. And nothing to do with me, Gov, is the general line. And that is still the line that Facebook has been taking lately. But I don't think that that's tenable when it's so obvious that these are more than just platforms. These are giant publishers, even if they're not originating that much of the content themselves.
You said that in your sort of experience of Silicon Valley is a democratic or certainly liberal bloc, but there are quite important, very right-wing figures in Silicon Valley, like Peter Thiel, people who sort of are, you know, real free-roaming libertarians. And yeah. Peter Thiel got behind Trump quite early on.
I was waiting for another name.
I couldn't think of
count
one.
Them on the fingers of one finger.
But Peter Thiel's a big one.
Peter, whom I know well, is unusual because he came out as a Trump supporter and was vilified, almost ostracized for it. There was enormous pushback. As a social milieu, Silicon Valley is deeply hostile to the president, partly out of self-interest. They do not like the immigration restrictions that yes. seem to be a key part of Trumpism. Silicon Valley relies on immigrants. Talented immigrants are a huge part of what
but also
has made it possible.
Untalented immigrants too, because for the Uber economy to work, you need a...
The truth is that Silicon Valley is a play on globalization of labor as well as of technology. You need the Asians to make the gadgets cheaply to make the smartphones available to everybody. So in the end, Silicon Valley was bound to be against Trump's populism because populism in Trump's version was basically anti-globalization on immigration, on trade, you name it. So I think Peter's unusual because the number of Silicon Valley people who share his view is not zero, but it's single digits, and they've learnt to be a lot more quiet about it. So there's another reason for this, and that is that Silicon Valley wants to wear its liberal and left liberal credentials on its T-shirt in order to reassure its favourite demographic, young, relatively well-off people, that it's with them. If you are Facebook, what is your biggest nightmare? It's not actually Donald Trump. It's Snapchat. Because when you look at the numbers, an alarmingly large proportion of the under 30s and a huge proportion of the under 20s have actually migrated from Facebook to Snapchat. And you mustn't at all costs alienate these hypersensitive types. I know them well from classrooms at Harvard, who are very apt to switch sides if you get a reputation for being politically incorrect. Look what happened to Uber. As soon as it turned out that Travis Kalanick had, let us say, less than enlightened views on a whole range of issues, including sex, people were switching to Lyft in droves. So The reason that Silicon Valley is running around signaling how right on it is, I think, is partly to make sure that the key demographic, the prosperous younger consumer, stays on board the platforms. Charlottesville was defining in this respect. The protest by white supremacists and neo-Nazis, which elicited the counter-protest by a whole motley crew, including some Antifa elements, and culminated in the death of a young woman, that was an aha moment in American politics generally, because Trump's failure to be sufficiently quick to say the things that liberals wanted him to say, he did say them actually, but he didn't say them enough, and he seemed to contradict them when he said there were two sides, which was actually true, but then he said there were good people on both sides, which was a little harder to get away with. All of that led to a great spasm of virtue signaling, one of the most extraordinary spectacles of recent times, as one Silicon Valley company after another rushed to prove that it deplored the president, it deplored what had happened at Charlottesville, and they started throwing money at dreadful people like the Southern Poverty Law Center, extraordinarily dodgy organization. That, I think, is part of what's going on. So in their enthusiasm to virtue signal, I think the Silicon Valley companies have essentially outed themselves as the sworn enemies of the president. And it's clear that that means they're going to, in practice, make it much harder for the right to use those platforms for political ends, which they did in 2016. Isn't going to happen in 2018.
It seems even when they try, they don't really do it. So Richard Spencer, who's a sort of white supremacist who was very involved in the Charlottesville protest, he was thrown off Twitter and then I think sort of got himself back on Twitter. So, and has a similarly large account as he had before he was thrown off. So I don't really understand it's possible to block them.
It's difficult actually to keep people off these platforms, even if you want to, because there's an element of whack-a-mole. I mean, Islamic State has been tremendously good at reinstating itself. Every time one account is closed down, just another gets opened up. Part of the problem for the network platforms is that they are managing fast too many people, accounts, and too much content to cope. I mean, in the end, there are 2 billion plus users of Facebook using it at least once a month. Imagine trying to edit that many articles. The reality is they can't, but they have to claim that they can in order to assuage the feelings of European and American politicians who say something terrible is on your platform. What are you going to do about it? And they say, oh, the algorithms failed again, but don't worry, we're going to hire some fact checkers and some editorial people. And this is all a complete fantasy too, because there's no way you can possibly edit that much stuff, and there's no way you can possibly monitor that many accounts. However, what's clearly happened is that the companies have set up a whole bunch of new initiatives to keep hate speech off. I mean, this is something explicitly said by YouTube, for example. And so there is a policy that says we're going to keep hate speech off, or at least we're going to minimize its presence. And I think that's an extremely dangerous and slippery slope, because who decides what hate speech is? Mm-hmm. Is it Mark Zuckerberg? Is it going to be the Southern Poverty Law Center to whom it will be delegated? So I think Republicans are somewhat sleepwalking at the moment, in that as things currently stand in the United States, it is essentially up to the network platforms to decide what hate speech is and who gets kicked off the internet. I mean, the CEO of Cloudflare, which is one of these service providing companies you don't hear so much about, basically kicked one of the white supremacist websites off the internet just after Charlottesville, on an impulse. And he, I think, correctly said that that was indefensible. It's indefensible that people like him should decide who gets onto the internet. But that's kind of where we are. And I think if the Republicans don't waken up to the severity of the threat that this poses, they're going to be at a much bigger disadvantage in the midterm elections and at the next presidential elections than they currently realise.
That was Neil Ferguson and Freddie Gray.
What are you drinking this weekend? Start a cellar plan with Berry Brothers and Rudd, and soon you could be uncorking something out of the ordinary. To start your cellar collection, visit bbr.com/cellarplan.
Hi, I'm Sam Leith, host of the Spectator's Books podcast. This week's episode sees me talk to Alan Hollinghurst, the Booker Prize-winning novelist whose new book, The Sparsholt Affair, and about why gay literature isn't like it used to be.
Next, after a shaky performance at Tory conference, Theresa May made an inauspicious return to the limelight this week as she was grilled on Brexit by Ian Dale. This floundering is the new normal for the Prime Minister, writes James Forsyth in his column this week, and he joins me now alongside Ian Dale to discuss. So James, Theresa May hasn't had a great 7 days. Is this now the new normal for her?
I think this is the great worry for the Tories, is that this isn't her worst week ever, it's just kind of how things are going to be. Even inside Downing Street, there are people who worry that while they are strong enough to repel the plotters, that they can stop her from being forced from office, they are not strong enough to truly take back control of the agenda. And so every time she looks vulnerable, the plotters are going to come back and have another go. And every time they'll have another 2 or 3 more MPs, and they'll slowly get closer and closer and closer to 46. I think that is the great fear.
Ian, you interviewed the Prime Minister this week on your radio show. She made a number of comments which may not help her standing with MPs, particularly the idea that she might not vote Leave in another referendum. Were you surprised by that?
I was surprised that she couldn't give an answer to that question, because it must be something that somebody somewhere along the line would have said to her. Well, you might be asked this, particularly because I asked Jeremy Hunt the same question during the Tory conference, and much to my surprise, he said, well, I was a devout Remainer, but the European Commission have acted appallingly in the last year, and George Osborne's predictions of dire economic woes haven't come true. So, yeah, if there was a referendum now, I'd vote out.
What do you think the reaction in the Conservative Party is going to be to that?
I was talking to a Tory MP this morning, who said that he'd been talking about this with some colleagues over breakfast, and he said the reaction actually wasn't as excitable as he thought it might be. I don't know why that would be, because
maybe they hadn't woken up yet.
They hadn't had their sort of ready breakfast. I agree with what James said about the fact that this is going to become the new normal, because you're both far too young to remember the Major years, but this is exactly a repeat of what happened then, when John Major was in all sorts of trouble. OK, he did have a small majority at the beginning, but by the end of the Parliament, that had frittered away. And the press would take any opportunity to sort of pour a bucket of whatever over him. And they are going to do that with Theresa May, even the Conservative press. I mean, I think Number 10 were, shall we say, not exactly happy about the way the answers to those questions were written up yesterday in some of the papers. But it's inevitable. It's going to happen.
I think there's a more fundamental point than how the Tory party reacts to this, which is she is seeing through the most radical change in how Britain has been governed in 40 years. There are going to be some hairy moments. If she is not certain that that is in the national interest, that is going to cut through to voters. And because Ian has now asked the question, and because she has failed to answer it, every interviewer from now on is going to say, look at this thing happen. You see the economy slowing down. Are you sure this is the right thing to do, Prime Minister? Do you in your heart of hearts think it's right? And I think that is a big problem for her.
And even worse than that, it actually damages her negotiating position with the EU, because on the other side of the table, if they feel that she doesn't really believe in what she's doing, they can exploit that.
So how's it going to go down with the Cabinet, James, with those like David Davis, who are actually charged with sitting at that table for a long time over the next few months, saying, well, actually, no, we do believe in Brexit and don't listen to the Prime Minister?
I think it has frustrated Leave supporting Cabinet ministers, because they can see all the implications that Ian alludes to. I think it has worried some Remain supporting Cabinet ministers, because they now fear that they're going to get the same question from every interviewer. And what I thought was telling last night was that Damian Green also entertained it. They'd be much better off adapting this Ruth Davidson line, saying we're not Leavers or Remainers anymore, we're just Brits, and basically just saying that this is all in the past and that they're not going to address it. But I think one of the worries is, and I think this is a worry has been stoked by Philip Hammond's column in the Times this morning, is that there are some people in the Cabinet who would rather be proved right in their referendum judgment than make the best deal possible.
In terms of their dire predictions, you mean?
Yes, I think this is... Because I think if you look at what Philip Hammond says about only spending the money necessary to prepare for no deal, when it's essentially clear that that's where the talks are heading, the problem with that is that's too late. Mm. If you only spend the money at that point to start, you know, creating the port capacity at Dover and all that stuff, when it is obvious that the talks are heading towards no deal, you won't actually be prepared for no deal. And one of the things that worries me is that if you don't prepare for no deal, you are encouraging, you're creating almost irresistible temptation for the EU at the last minute to demand a few extra concessions because you can't walk away. And one of those concessions might be something that a UK Prime Minister considers that they can't do politically. And so you then have the worst of all worlds, where the talks collapse and you get chaos at the very last minute.
But the interesting thing is that it is the Prime Minister who's been talking up the possibility of no deal over the past couple of weeks. And I wonder whether now was the right time to do that. I don't know the answer to that question, but she has talked it up. And the other question, which hasn't got so much coverage in the media today is her answers on what happens to EU nationals under no deal, and indeed what happens to British citizens in Europe under no deal. And she just said, I don't know. Thinking, well, what's the point of raising this if you actually haven't got a plan?
I also feel on this EU nationals point, a prime minister should never say, I don't know. You particularly should never say, I don't know about something that actually affects the lives of millions of people living in this country. I do think on this that she could have said, look, obviously where the negotiations are bogged down is in very technical questions about family reunions, whether there should be income thresholds for non-EU spouses of people marrying EU. But she could have said, look, on the basic principle, you will still be able to stay, live, work here, retire here, none of that is changing, and then said and offered some reassurance. I think it was,
exactly. And I gave her three opportunities to do that, and I kind of genuinely wanted her to do that, which is odd for an interview in some ways. And then the final hour and 20 minutes of my show after she left, it was just filled with people who had been here for 20 years, from Poland, from wherever, saying, well, I feel now more unsettled than ever. So instead of providing the reassurance that you talk of, it absolutely had the opposite effect. And these are human beings. These are not sort of pawns. They're actually individuals who've given a lot to this country.
So this new normal is very unsettling, as you both say, for people looking at politics, thinking, actually, this is going to make my life much more difficult, potentially make my life hell, basically. Did the Prime Minister strike you as being in charge? It sounds very much to me as though she's not, if she can't answer those big questions or even give a plausible answer.
Well, I think on everything else, she did give quite plausible answers. We spent, I think, nearly 15 minutes on the racial diversity audit. Was that what it's called?
Disparity.
I knew it was die something. And she was very good on that. And that is a personal project of hers, and good on her for that. And she interacted with Call as well. I mean, everyone says, oh, she doesn't do very well with individuals. Well, actually, she was fine. But of course, nobody remembers the questions that she asked about the conference or her leadership or whatever. It is now just down to the fact that she couldn't answer the questions on Brexit.
And you mentioned the racial disparity audit, which is her attempt to move the debate back onto a domestic agenda, which she did try to do in her speech, James. What did we learn about the new domestic normal under Theresa May in that speech and in the days afterwards?
I think the new domestic normal is that it's booted out of the news by Brexit pretty quickly. I mean, this is the irony for her, is that she genuinely has a domestic agenda. Now,
A big domestic agenda?
Some people in the cabinet complain that it's just a beefed up Home Office agenda. But, you know, I remember one cabinet minister said to me after the speech last week, the problem with the speech is there was not a single policy in it to make the country richer or more prosperous. You know, where is her economics here?
And this was a cabinet minister saying this to you. You see, that is sickening in a way for Tory party supporters. You think he or she is a cabinet minister. For God's sake, you're sitting around the cabinet table. Do something about it.
I think there's a tension here, which is this, that first of all, the wounds created pre-election by how the cabinet felt that they were treated by a very imperial number 10 have not healed. I also think that discipline breaks down with a weak Prime Minister. You know, you were citing the John Major years. You know, I think this is a perennial problem. When the Prime Minister is too weak, you can't stop this stuff from happening. There's a great bit in John Major's autobiography when he complains about how cabinet ministers used to come for lunch at the Spectator or the Telegraph and basically launch a leadership campaign that would run for a week or two, and then, you know, the next person would come to lunch and the next person would be the saviour. You contrast that with Tony Blair in 1997, who at his first cabinet meeting said, cabinet ministers, no one speaks to a journalist unless you go through me or Alastair Campbell. And the remarkable thing is that rule pretty much held for the first couple of years of the Blair government.
So when is Amber Rudd coming for lunch at the Spectator?
That was James Forsyth and Ian Dale.
Why wait for tomorrow's papers? The best analysis of the day's news is already on Coffee House. To subscribe to the Evening Blend email in order to receive the best of the Spectator each day, just head to spectator.co.uk/blend.
And finally, PC speak and jargon have overwhelmed the traditions of our language. So claims Claire Fox in the magazine this week as she rails against the changes that she believes have confused the beautiful simplicity of English. But is this a fair judgment? Or is she just stuck in her ways? She joins me now alongside our literary editor Sam Leith, whose new book, Right to the Point, is out today. So Claire, 52% of Britons now say that Britain sometimes feels like a foreign country. Why is this?
Often that's understood to be, they must be anti-foreigner. People are speaking a different language. Maybe they're all speaking Polish or Punjabi. But the piece that I've written is trying to explain how actually there's a whole new language that's emerged that's full of very specific linguistic niceties around diversity, a kind of politically correct, although it's a lazy phrase, language code that people just don't understand and can't relate to. And I was obviously linking this a little bit with Brexit, as everything is linked these days, to try and explain that people felt alienated at home, not because of foreigners, but because of this kind of metropolitan, understood by a minority of people, language, where they couldn't keep up with all the different phrases that they're meant to use and so on.
So what's our sort of British equivalent of the Académie Française, the sort of politically correct arbiters who are setting this new language?
I don't know. Well, first of all, it's not so formal, because if it was, at least you could go and study it. It's often by going to university, learning the language of safe spaces, trigger warnings, what's offensive, what pronouns one is meant to use and not meant to use. Certain words are absolutely no-no. I can't keep up myself, and I'm fairly familiar with it. I mean, I find myself saying LGBTQ, and I can't even remember whether I'm missing a letter. And I know that people frown if I say it incorrectly. There are certain words that suddenly become verboten. Suddenly I hear people and hear myself saying people of colour, a phrase which is so ugly I can't bear it, but has become now an acceptable phrase that one is meant to use in relation to BAME. What's BAME? And so on and so forth. So my point is that where I'm from originally in North Wales, people I grew up with haven't got a chance when trying to just have a conversation to keep up with this, and then can be written off as bigots or racists or homophobic if they say the wrong word. So you're walking on eggshells the whole time.
Sam, do you agree that our language is becoming much more elitist? If you want to be kind, you actually have to learn a whole tranche of jargon.
I think up to a point. I mean, I sort of agree that there's certainly some of the usages that are, you know, very current in universities and it's sort of cutting edge of inclusive and diversity, okay, language are sort of slightly disconcerting to some people. But I think a sort of general movement towards a shift in the language isn't such a bad thing. I mean, I think you don't want to get in the position of being those people who used to write letters to the Daily Telegraph 20 years ago deploring the corruption of the perfectly good English word gay. And I think it's certainly true that in quite narrow, yes, academic circles, there's a particular kind of set of shibboleths that have become, you know, to do with establishing an in-group and an out-group. But I think actually what we're seeing is the sort of general idea of, you know, I mean, political correctness is often, you know, it's a sort of boo word for what we wouldn't have any trouble with if we called it courtesy. And it seems to me it's not that difficult to take on board some of these ideas. And, you know, I think quite a lot of what's happening is we're talking about something that's quite small, that's starting out in, say, universities or, you know, academic departments. And what's percolating it out into the wider world and making it, if you like, disconcerting to these 52% is the fact that they read the sort of hit pieces on it. The disproportionate preoccupation by people who really are in positions of power and, you know, who are writing pieces for The Spectator, pieces for the Daily Mail, doing kind of little Scott issues in the Sunday Times. De Montfort University Students' Union issues some probably slightly daft but well-meaning proclamation, and it's all over the papers as there's a new language police, the Stasi are here. And I think that, weirdly, rather like the first time political correctness was a subject of discussion, the backlash is much more voluble than the lash.
Claire, isn't Sam right that this is actually just kindness? And sometimes it's kindness by well-meaning but slightly stupid people or slightly young people who, you know, students are just 18 to 21-year-olds who are trying to find their way in the world. They don't mean any harm. In fact, they mean quite the opposite. And they may end up trying to introduce terms that don't make any sense, but it's from the very best of intentions.
Well, I'm as irritated by the kind of politically correct gone mad arguments as anyone else, even though I know people will try and characterise what I've written in that direction, which is not what I'm saying at all. And in fact, it's not, sadly, confined to kind of the lingo of students. And the point I make is that I actually write a lot for a local government magazine, the MJ, which is why I was asked to write this, is that it's all pervasive in local government and in councils and in people of power, people who run organisations. So, you know, the diktat that went out to staff saying that you had to call pregnant women, but you had to say pregnant people, these kind of things. I use the example of the kind of war against banter being issued against people who work in the fire service and the rescue service, who are basically told that the words that they use will not be tolerated. And
what sort
I don't
of
think,
words are they?
Well, when they talk about, well, I don't, you see, they say banter. So and this is the point about the kind of kindness. You know, there's a danger here that people will say, oh, she wants everyone to use the N-word all the time, and why does it matter? I'm not saying that. I'm saying it's a whole way of distinguishing that, in a sort of virtue signaling way, this is, I am the right kind of person because I use these kind of phrases, this kind of language. And then the policing of the informal interactions that people use. On the kindness point, you see, I think it's the opposite of kindness, because I think it's a form of tyranny in a way. And it's a way of demonising people that I think is unfair. People who are kind and open and generous, if they use the wrong language, can be written off as bigots. And I think that's unkind. And it's not just students who are doing it. It's people in positions of power who run newspapers, who are in politics, who run the country.
Sam, isn't that right, that actually the lack of clarity is a way of trying to humiliate other people? I was talking to an MP recently who was desperate to find out what pansexual meant before she offended anyone, because she thought it was the same as bisexual, but she didn't want to say that out loud because she was worried she'd get a mob after her. And she didn't mean any harm by this. She just wanted to understand what it meant. Now, I wasn't actually able to explain this to her because I didn't understand it either. And
I think
as it got to the point
where
asking what these things mean is actually difficult as well.
Yeah, I think there is certainly a case that some of these terms are policed, and some of them, you know, almost too much power is given to the language by the people who are saying, you know, if you use the wrong term. You know, I'm no lover of all these acronyms either. But I think in the same way that the sort of incremental process by which we moved away. You talk, Claire, in your article about these things being opaque. And I think some of them, particularly the elaborate acronyms, can be very opaque. And the question of whether you leave your asterisk off the end of LGBTQ and that consigns you to outer darkness, of course, that's kind of an outlier. But over the years, the usages we've had have changed, and often for the better. I mean, I think if it's a freedom of speech issue, I mean, if you're going to die in a ditch for your right to call a transsexual person a tranny or an Inuit an Eskimo, it seems to me that's the wrong battle to be picking in the freedom of speech department. I mean, freedom of speech is more important than nomenclature. It's about the exchange of ideas. And I think where I agree with you, Claire, is that where certain ideas become verboten rather than simply the kind of slightly revolutive language, that's where it's a much bigger dish.
In fact, that's why I don't want to particularly fetishise language. I was using it as illustrative. And that's why I sort of talk about people feeling alienated as though they're in a foreign country. It takes the form of a language discussion. But just to use something that I haven't written about, but which I've spoken about, which was there was recently in something of a furore around the naming of chocolates nutters, because they were nutty, covered in chocolates, and this would be offensive to the mentally ill. And I was on the radio a lot with people who work in mental health charities. Now, I worked for Mind. I'm very interested in mental health issues. And I felt that the debate trivialised the issue. And what was said to me in these exchanges when I was doing the media was, you know, anyone who buys those and doesn't realise and are offending mentally ill people. And I said, you're trivialising the real problems that people face when they are mentally ill through making it about this language. So actually, I'm not the person trying to make the issues about language. My fear is that you won't be able to speak freely in a free speech sense. At a time when we face some of the biggest challenges society's ever faced, I want society to be able to talk with each other without writing each other off because they happen to say the wrong thing inadvertently in that conversation.
That was Claire Fox and Sam Leith. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. You can subscribe to our other shows, including Holy Smoke, our religion podcast hosted by Damien Thompson and Christina Adoni. And if you enjoy the podcasts, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed on this podcast, as well as great pieces by Tristram Hunt, Patrick Kidd, and an interview with Robert Harris. And we have a special offer for podcast listeners. 12 issues for £12 and a limited edition Spectator moleskin notebook if you subscribe at spectator.co.uk/pod offer. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.